Hello, and welcome to Media News Podcast with me, Mark Campbell. Media News aims to be an authentic voice, bringing you real truthful stories from the Middle East with a particular focus on the Kurdish question that is often ignored, self-censored or suppressed by the mainstream media platforms. Our subject this week is Turkey's blocking of Sweden and Finland's applications to join the NATO alliance after Russia's military invasion of Ukraine, and what this will mean for the Kurds. And I'm so very happy to say that joining us today to give us her thoughts is Ida Kaiko, a Finnish academic and feminist activist, researching the criminalization of the Kurdish freedom movement at the Information Security Group at Royal Holloway University of London. Ida, a very warm welcome to Media News.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. So on the 18th of May, 2022, it became apparent that the applications of Sweden and Finland to join the NATO bloc as a result of Russia's military invasion of Ukraine were going to be blocked by fellow NATO member Turkey. The excuse given by Turkey's President Erdogan was that Turkey accused Sweden and Finland of supporting and harboring Kurdish militants or terrorists. Erdogan said in a speech in the Turkish Assembly, "We asked for over 30 terrorists. They said, we are not giving them. You won't hand over terrorists, but you want to join NATO? We cannot say yes to a security organization that is devoid of security," he said. Aso Vian, a member of the Diplomacy Commission of the Kurdish Democratic Community Center, a representative body of the Kurdish community in Finland, commented, "By blocking Sweden and Finland from joining NATO, Erdogan wants to blackmail NATO and the USA, and also to get a green light from Russia to occupy more territories in Rojava." NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg recently said that he thought that Turkey's concerns about terrorism were legitimate. Aso Vian again said in an interview for Declassified UK, "Accepting any demands of Turkey means killing more civilians, ethnic cleansing, and demographic change, empowering dictatorship and eradicating democracy." Well, to take a deeper look into this issue and see how Erdogan's threats are being taken in the Nordic countries themselves, joining us today is Finnish researcher Ida Kaiko. Welcome again, Ida.
Thank you.
I believe that you have been monitoring the Finnish media and press and the reactions in Finland to Turkey's threats of this veto to Sweden and Finland's accession to the NATO applications, which I will ask you about. But first of all, it might be nice for our readers if I could perhaps ask you if you could give our listeners a little bit of contextual background history, specifically to Finland and Finland's historic relations with Turkey and their support or relations with the Kurdish struggle for rights in the Middle East. Perhaps we can start there.
Yes, of course. So Finland really has a fairly standard relationship with the Turkish state in terms of its, you know, a kind of diplomatic relationship, which involves a certain kind of balancing act when you're dealing with a state like Turkey. This is obviously a problem that a lot of European states encounter. In the context of the Nordic countries, it's always good to point out that obviously these are countries that really brand themselves as kind of progressive defenders of democracy, but they're actually not always that consistent in their actions, despite what they're saying and kind of, you know, projecting to the world. So Finland and Turkey have, you know, trade relations. There's a lot of tourism, obviously, from Finland to Turkey. And Finland crucially supported Turkey's EU accession bid and has done that pretty consistently. So there has been an attempt to kind of maintain relatively close relations, although Finland has also simultaneously throughout criticized Turkey for human rights violations and specifically its treatment of Kurds and obviously its numerous at this point invasions in Kurdistan into both Rojava, West Kurdistan, and Bashur, South Kurdistan. And Finland was the first country to put a ban in place on arms sales in 2019 following Turkey's invasion of Rojava back then, obviously followed pretty much within a day by, you know, Sweden, Norway, and then the UK and various other European states. That's the kind of general context between Finland and Turkey. In terms of Finland and the Kurds, that relationship is obviously quite of a different nature, because it's not a kind of state diplomatic relationship. The Finnish Defence Forces have provided training for the Kurdish Peshmerga in Bashur in South Kurdistan, in their fight against the Islamic State, so-called Islamic State. But it's not a close relationship. And really, you could say that Sweden has a much closer relationship with the Kurds generally. This is in part due to Sweden having a quite large diaspora community, which is quite old in a kind of European context. So there's been Kurds arriving and settling and integrating in Sweden for decades now, starting in the 70s, which is quite a different situation from Finland. Finland has a much smaller, much younger Kurdish diaspora. And this means that there are a lot of Kurds who are very active in Swedish politics, including MPs, as many people might have recently been made aware. And this has obviously led to Sweden having quite a different geopolitical stance on the autonomous administration in northern East Syria and much closer relationships with that. But there's been diplomatic relationship building and visits back and forth, both from Sweden and Finland to the autonomous administration.
Okay.
Sweden has the, you know, Sweden has a much kind of closer and more formalized relationship with the Kurdish people.
Okay, that's really interesting. Thank you for that. So, goodness gracious me. So what, in your opinion, is Erdogan's motives for this veto coming out of nowhere of these two Nordic countries, Finland and Sweden's applications to join NATO?
I think it's important to see it, and this is certainly how it's seen in Finland and Sweden, as something in which Finland and Sweden are actually pretty minor players. This is Turkey and specifically Erdogan trying to influence all of NATO and especially the United States. And really, this is a kind of vehicle to push Turkey's own interests within NATO as much as outside of it. Obviously, you know, it's important to note that Turkey is right now getting ready and already starting another invasion into both South and West Kurdistan, in its continuing its long war on Kurds. And Erdogan wants carte blanche for this if he can't get what he really wants, which is active support. So that's further arms deals and actually support from NATO in its invasion. Obviously, this invasion is against international law. Previous invasions have already displaced millions of people, and Turkey historically has supported Islamic State jihadists and militants. So this is something that really should be obviously and clearly condemned by the West and by NATO, but it hasn't been. And this has created an environment in which Turkey is able to push its own agenda, continue its repression and attacks on Kurdish people, which really has to be seen as genocide, because this is the Turkish state trying to destroy all attempts to build Kurdish autonomy and self-determination, most of which have nothing to do with the Turkish state, which are not happening within its borders. And when they are happening within its borders, obviously Turkey uses the tools of legislative and police to basically destroy any form of Kurdish political organization. Obviously, this is all condemned by NATO members. It's condemned on the level of words, but less on the level of actions. And Turkey is trying to use this opportunity to force the West into accepting and supporting its own geopolitical interests.
Yeah, and I mean, Ida, considering your research on the criminalization of the Kurds, if we could just talk for 5 minutes about, so to people who might be watching this or listening to this, is Sweden and Finland like a hotbed of Kurdish terrorists? all brandishing AK-47s and hijacking airplanes? Or how do we explain this to people who may not know, be used to, or understand Turkey's language when it comes to the Kurds?
Well, Turkey is using the age-old playbook of branding anyone a terrorist who opposes an authoritarian state. And this has to be really seen in the context of, you know, there are numerous similar disputes going on around the world. And it's obviously within my field, which is security studies, it's a well-worn phrase that someone's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. But this rhetoric can also be used to actually obscure facts as well. It's not enough to say, maybe, you know, for some people, maybe if you go to Turkey, people there will see Kurds as terrorists, but here we might see them differently. That's not enough, because actually we have to dig into what is being done rhetorically when branding people as terrorists. And this is something that Turkey has been doing really consistently for decades, to the point where various people, not just Kurds, but journalists, political activists, even politicians in Turkey are well known for joking about the kind of terrorists that they are. It's a fully expected label. And we have to understand that there is no reasonable security concern that the Turkish state actually does have. All of this discussion about, you know, Turkey's legitimate security concerns, which we have to listen to, is really just giving in to that rhetoric and giving them leeway to use existing legislation also within Europe to their own interests. And those interests are the repression and genocide of Kurds and the complete destruction of Kurdish autonomy wherever it occurs. And I think for a lot of people in Europe, there's a lack of understanding exactly how much this is happening in our own context and in our own countries, and how much of it is done by our own governments. The UK is a really prime example of this, where the UK obviously maintains a close diplomatic relationship with Turkey. It's a NATO ally as well. And it readily and happily criminalizes Kurdish political activists and even just community organizers, Kurdish community members, and their internationalist supporters who stand in solidarity with them within British borders. Some of these people are British citizens, some of them are EU citizens, and many of them are refugees and asylum seekers who've been granted status within the UK on the basis of their brutal treatment by the Turkish state within Turkey. And the UK then turns around and quite happily threatens people with extradition to Turkey and monitors and surveils community organizing, raids community centers, raids people's homes, performs arrests, and then goes on to prosecutions, which very, very rarely have any success, because there's actually no basis to this. What Turkey sees as terrorism is things like using a certain messaging app, which allows for greater privacy, posting critical comments about the Turkish state on social media, associating with certain people, holding certain political symbols on a demonstration. These are things that we in the West, or our government certainly, would like to champion as normal civil rights and human rights. So in criminalizing these activities when they are done by Kurdish people or people associated with Kurdish political organizing, our own governments in Europe are actually completely giving into Turkey's rhetoric and Turkey's narrative, in which basically any Kurdish person is a terrorist, but so is their family, their friends, their political allies. It's just a never-ending network of terrorism. And this is what we have to be very critical about when the Turkish state says that Finland and Sweden are hotbeds for Kurdish terrorism. What Turkey means by that is there is less repression in Finland and Sweden of Kurdish political organizing than in some other European countries. Germany and the UK are prime examples of states which actually have a very, very harsh line on Kurdish political organizing. Whereas Finland and Sweden collaborate to a degree with Kurdish political parties and Kurdish organizations. We have to also bear in mind that Finland and Sweden are EU members, and therefore they do subscribe to the ban of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. So there is very little that Turkey can actually say that would be very convincing in terms of saying these countries are supporting terrorists. But according to the popular definition of terrorism, as created by the Turkish state over a number of decades, sure, Kurdish MPs can be terrorists. Kurdish political organizers and people who go to demonstrations in support of Kurdistan, trying to defend Kurdistan from a Turkish invasion. Sure, these people are terrorists according to Turkey's own twisted logic.
It just made me think, just there as you were speaking, that, you know, in regards to the criminalization aspect of the PKK, and these vetoes that Turkey are applying to Sweden and Finland, that there have just in recent years been a number of successful legal challenges to the proscription of the PKK. And there's actually been quite a flurry of activity, legal cases being submitted. Both, obviously, the famous one being the Brussels court case, which found that the PKK which was one of the first times actually that that it's, you know, been really looked at in depth in a court of law, and the Brussels court case found that that the PKK were certainly not a terrorist organization, but were simply a partner in an armed conflict. And just recently, another very important case has been submitted to the European Court of Justice. I mean, do you think that this action against Finland and Sweden just might be, an action by Erdogan to somehow think that he can thwart these cases going through and just to try and reinforce his criminalization of the Kurds?
I think absolutely. And also what we're seeing already, for example, in Belgium, is that these legislative decisions, legal decisions about the status of the PKK, are being ignored or challenged by these very same governments that have created the legal framework in which those decisions are made. So in Belgium, for example, the Belgian government, immediately following that Supreme Court decision that the PKK is not a terrorist organization, but a party in an armed conflict, the government immediately put out a statement saying they were not going to respect this ruling of their own Supreme Court, but they were going to continue to criminalize Kurds on the basis of their supposed involvement with the PKK, which is also, like, we have to make it very clear, this is a very tenuous link and is playing into the hands, again, of Turkey, who says all Kurds are PKK terrorists. So what we're seeing is a precedent being set for Turkey in which it can use avenues of diplomacy and or intimidation to make states ignore these decisions that are made within courts. So this opens up a whole new way of thinking about this, because we're not just looking at, okay, what is actually strictly legal? What are the legal definitions of terrorism? And, you know, we just have to follow the letter of the law. That's not the case at all. Turkey sees that there's a backdoor into continuing repression and criminalization, regardless of what decisions get made on the status of the PKK in the courts. And we've also seen that the EU has very much wavered on whether or not the PKK should be included on terror listings. The PKK has been removed, then it's been put back when Turkey has exerted pressure. And Turkey knows that it has all kinds of little knobs it can twist to make the EU squirm, to make individual NATO or EU member states squirm, and therefore make them toe the line that the Turkish state has set.
So it's a completely political decision, is what you're saying. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the law. So in that case, can we look at public opinion in Finland, perhaps? How has Finland responded to Erdogan's threat so far? Not just the government, but parties, you know, opposition parties and the general public in Finland. How has Finland responded to Erdogan's threat so far? And do you think that Finland will give in to Turkey's demands?
Well, this is really interesting, and I want to give a little bit of background around Finland and NATO as well. Because, for example, Finland and Sweden have very different historical contexts and relationships when it comes to Russia and also when it comes to NATO. So Finland fought two wars with the Soviet Union, as it was at the time, during World War II. And there's a lot of anti-Russian sentiment, but also a lot of fear in Finland concerning a Russian invasion. And I think it's important to understand that for a lot of people...
It has a very long border, doesn't it, with Russia?
Exactly, yeah. It's over 1,000 kilometers. And for a lot of people, looking at what's been happening in Ukraine over the last couple of months, people have really imagined, could that happen here? Will it happen here? So even though Finland has had, for decades, quite a generally anti-NATO popular stance. If you look at polling, it's always kind of, you know, well over 50% of the population is opposed to NATO membership. This shifted completely and very radically just a couple months ago. And this is also in the context of the Cold War, in which Finland kind of followed the Soviet Union's geopolitical line, and the Soviet Union really had a huge amount of influence in Finnish domestic and geopolitical decisions. And this, for many people, is seen as a very shameful period of Finnish history, in which Finland was nominally a sovereign, not sovereign in reality. Sweden has quite a different context, and I think it's important to kind of look into that a little bit as well. Sweden obviously has been a great Nordic power and has not fought any wars in centuries, and has been able to remain independent and neutral for a very long time now. And Sweden also has had a much kind of clearer internationalist and clearly kind of left-wing political opposition to NATO, whereas in Finland it's been more pragmatic as well. It has come out of a fear also of provoking the Soviet Union or provoking Russia. So what we're looking at now is a gigantic shift in attitudes, both in Finland and in Sweden. In Finland, definitely driven by fear, which has managed to create a kind of climate of political unity, but which has also been heavily, heavily pushed by Finnish media, which tends to be quite centrist or even conservative, on a Finnish level conservative, in its political views, and has really pushed that joining NATO will create a sense of security. And crucially, I think it's really important to note that this is a lot about nuclear weapons as well. It's about joining a so-called nuclear deterrent, having that guarantee that a nuclear weapon being used against Finland would create a retaliation. So that's the context. So what has happened this spring in Finland is a huge swing in public opinion, aided by the media, and also something that has been really bought into by Finnish politicians in all parties. Even though if we look at the left, there's a lot of criticisms of NATO and a lot of skepticism around NATO, but that's still by and large been the case. Whereas in Sweden, this has been more of a kind of real political discussion around what would NATO membership mean? Why should we join? And it's a decision that has also been pushed by a fear of being left as the only Baltic state that is not a NATO member. So what we come to now is a situation in which in Finland, especially on the right, NATO has been presented as, you know, Finland finally fully becoming a Western state. Finland is finally joining the ranks of democracy and human rights, which to many of us who are on the left is completely nonsensical when it comes to NATO. But it's been very, very difficult to make those political arguments in Finland throughout the last couple of months, because immediately people have been accused of supporting Vladimir Putin for criticizing NATO in any way. So I think for a lot of people in Finland, this hurdle, this spanner in the works that Turkey has created, it came completely out of the blue. To those who've been following Turkey in any way over the last couple of years, obviously it was no surprise. So what we're looking at is two quite different responses. Sweden, which has historically been more critical of the Turkish state and had a closer relationship with Kurdish political movements, is actually seemingly making more concessions. Some people might say this is because Turkey likely has a much bigger problem with Sweden's NATO bid than Finland's because of Sweden's historic support for the Kurds. But I think it's also important to see that Sweden has had some of this discussion and already made some of these compromises on their long-held commitments to internationalism and to solidarity with the Kurds. They've already kind of had some of that discussion over the spring, saying Turkey might do something. They've been a bit more pragmatic than Finland, who kind of just rushed in almost kind of, you know, naively. So Sweden have already indicated that they might lift their arms embargo, which has been in place since 2019. Sweden is also a much bigger producer of arms than Finland is. So that's another thing to bear in mind. I think for Finland, this is less significant. There is this in Finland, there's this sense of, you know, maybe we can wait it out a little bit. Whereas in Sweden, I think there's more of a sense of we have to give something because, you know, because of their previous stances. They've also kind of very hesitant. They've been very, you know, hesitant on the question of extradition as well. So the Turkish state is demanding extradition of a number of Kurdish activists and politicians to Turkey. And just recently, it came out that the Swedish Secret Service, so their kind of intelligence arm of the police, has been part of the discussions that have been ongoing in Ankara. They were sent there as part of Sweden's diplomatic delegation. Obviously, this does not bode well because that arm of the police is exactly the one that might carry the vehicle activity within Sweden. Finland is less of a clear-cut case in terms of what they might do. There's been a very strong position that any extraditions would be unconstitutional in Finland and therefore they can't be carried out. The question of the arms embargo seems to have stalled. There's a real sense of we have to look at what Sweden is doing, but also we have to wait for the US to intervene. I think this is the bind that Finland and Sweden find themselves in relation to NATO, is that actually NATO, as I said previously, is not an organization that supports human rights. It's not an organization that supports democracy. And upholding those values within an organization like that is going to be very difficult. And yeah, finally, I do want to say that obviously the right wing in Finland is already kind of indicating that they might be happy to give in to Turkey's demands. There's an election next year in Finland. Currently, it looks like Finland's conservative party, the coalition party, might do very well indeed. Finland currently has a left-wing government, a left-wing coalition government, which is led by the Social Democratic Party and has a number of smaller parties in coalition as well. And one of those coalition parties is the Left Alliance Party, which, like I said, is part of the current government. It has about 8% of polling right now. And it's one of these kind of medium-sized parties that in Finland can be quite crucial in forming governments. And Finland's Left Alliance Party passed a resolution that they would push the EU to delist the PKK just last week in their party conference. It was put forward by the youth wing of the party, unsurprisingly. That's where we find the most solidarity and the most committed internationalism within the Finnish left is the youth wing. So that is obviously really promising, and that's a really good sign of the support that exists within the Finnish left and the understanding that exists concerning the Kurdish freedom movement and Kurdish political organizing in general. And obviously a lot of those grassroots links are very strong, and we are also seeing a younger generation of Kurdish activists within Finland getting involved in party politics, especially on the left, and really pushing for this kind of committed internationalism within those organizations. I think we have to recognize that the situation in Finland and Sweden is actually quite different. They're two quite different countries with a very different relationship with the Kurds. And there is really no clear cut. There's no clear path out of this. And while people feel scared and afraid, and there's a general sense of, you know, we felt, I think the thing to get across is a lot of people are saying, we thought that this NATO thing would be a done deal. We thought it would be quick. So while people are scared and while people, especially on the right, would be happy to throw Kurdish political rights under the bus, there's also a really growing sentiment of why would we even want to join NATO if the Turkish state behaves in this way and uses blackmail for their own geopolitical interests and, you know, blocks things that they basically agreed to publicly previously. So there is also a lot of criticism and a lot of kind of mockery as well, if I'm honest, of Turkey within Finland, and really like a expectation that in order for this gridlock to be undone, the US has to step in. But that's a huge question mark of what will the US do, and what kind of intervention would actually be useful at this point?
Yeah, gosh, there's so many angles to this question, aren't there? I'd love to carry on talking, but we are literally running out of time. I'd just really like to finish on coming back to what I was really struck by what Aso Vian, I saw a quote from him, said. By this idea that Turkey is blocking Sweden and Finland's NATO application for Russia, and why? Because Erdogan wants to get the green light from Russia's help in invading the north and east of Syria, of invading Rojava. What's your last thoughts on that, Ida?
I think that's entirely possible. It's entirely possible that there's some kind of backroom deal. That's one option. The other option is this is just Turkey exploiting a situation that has been presented on a silver platter to be exploited. And I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, this is also Turkey really thinking about how can we impose our geopolitical agenda, our security agenda on a global scale, and exploiting whatever relationships it has, and, you know, saying these are our terms. And, you know, we've watched the US, for example, have this kind of sway globally for decades now, where the US's security concerns become the world's security concerns, and you're either with them or not. And Turkey is really vying for that kind of position. This is a really, like, the growth that we're seeing in the Turkish state's imperialist aggression, not just against the Kurds, but also in Cyprus, also in what happened in Armenia, also its recent threats to Greece. Yeah. This is not a state that is happy to compromise and sit back and use diplomatic means. This is a state that really is vying for power, and is vying for power specifically on a global arena, and wants to impose its will on everyone. And if you're not with them, then what are you going to do?
Well, that's a great way to end up, Peter. And thank you. It absolutely is the case that Turkey are imminently threatening to invade Rojava, and they are, in fact, carrying out military operations in the north of Iraq, presumably with a view to expanding their borders for the 100th anniversary of the establishment of the modern Turkish state next year in 2023. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us, Ida. So Ida Kaiko, a Finnish academic, feminist activist researching the criminalization of the Kurdish freedom movement at the Information Security Group at Royal Holloway University in London. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.